Hello and welcome back to another Activated Authors Masterclass. And as we can see, I've got a very, very special guest, one of our very own Activated Authors in the hot seat. Jeff Adams has written stories since he was in middle school and became a published author in 2009 when his first short stories became available. He writes both romance and young adult fiction with queer characters, lives in Northern California with his husband of more than 20 years, and the co-host of the Big Gay Fiction podcast, a show devoted to queer romance as well as pop culture, Will Knauss. In his day job, Jeff is a web accessibility expert and he consults with companies around the world about making their digital experiences accessible. He's bringing that knowledge to other creative entrepreneurs with Content for Everyone, which helps creatives understand what they can do to create content that is accessible and usable by everyone. Jeff, great to have you. Great to see you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me here. I'm excited to get to talk about this and help educate the activated authors community.
Oh hell yes. And I will say that I can already see myself having to put my teeth in because even reading that intro, I'm like, accessibility, accessibility. It's gonna wrap around the tongue.
Yeah, it could be a mouthful sometimes.
But I mean, I've seen this book in various iterations and whatnot over the last few months. You've been keeping me posted about all your different progress and the development of this book, and it's really nice to see it come to fruition. And before we kind of jump into some of the bulk of what you want to show us and some of the questions, just a huge congratulations on the number one new release tag on Amazon. That must feel
Thank you.
fantastic.
Yes. Orange banner always feels good.
Especially on this is your first nonfiction piece as well, isn't it? So to have that kind of steam behind you.
Yeah, absolutely. Just thrilled about that because yeah, you're right. It's my first nonfiction. I've got a facility to release fiction. I know how to release fiction. I understand the nonfiction concept. I've learned a lot over the years, but to do it and put it into practice is like, okay, here we go.
Yeah,
Let's see what we can do.
it's a whole different machine. It's a whole different side. Well, for me anyway, it was a whole different side of like imposter syndrome and like worry about what I was teaching. And
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one thing I had with imposter syndrome is I know this stuff backwards and forwards. Presenting it to this audience was very different, but the base material was like, I know it so well, I could talk about it in my sleep practically.
Well, let's dive into some of that because, as we mentioned in the intro, this is your day job. This is now also a book that you've put together. It's not specific for authors, but authors can benefit a hell of a lot from everything that's in this book. I've been through it. I've seen all the stuff that's in there, and it's all I learned a lot taking away from some of the lessons in that book. So, just to begin with, what was the origin of this book, and why is this subject so important to you?
I've been in web accessibility now for 10 years in my day job, more than 10 years. And especially as I kind of crossed a certain threshold where I got here's some tongue twister for you. My certification as a understanding accessibility core competencies, which is a mind-bending test to take, I tell you. But as I kind of moved through getting that certification and getting more into the topic and learning more from people who are disabled and how they interact with the web and the barriers that they come across all the time, I started cleaning up my own websites, practice what you preach kind of thing to the degree that I could do it because I'm not technical. I understand all the stuff that needs to be done, but that doesn't mean I can do it either. And so it was really important to clean up my own sites. But then I see what authors post on social, the newsletters they create, what their websites you'll look like and how they behave. And I'm like, this is a segment of people who don't know what they don't know. They don't know they're putting barriers up potentially. They're doing what looks nice to them. They're doing what they know works for them, but that it may not work the same way for others. And so I really wanted to take my knowledge and boil down what would be good for creatives to know and what they could take action, if they're making their sites in like WordPress or Wix or Square or whatever that is, whatever their email platform is, the social media platforms, that exist. Taking the fundamentals that we talk about in the book allow you to improve what you're doing. And we also throw some stuff in. We give you information as well about some of the history of things and why things are what they are. And point you in some cases to like, if you're going to work with a designer or a developer, bring these things up or check these things on your site. You may not be able to fix them, but you'll know if they're working right or not. Maybe that would prompt you to get a new theme or, whatever that is. So you've got some knowledge to work with if you choose to. you've got some other knowledge that you can actually, you know, take action today in some cases to just go do things better.
Yeah. And so I have a host of questions and I have a lot of ways that I want to take this, but I know that you have put together a presentation to run through and kind of give an overview of what Content for Everyone is all about. Are you happy to jump into that now and start getting rocking?
Yeah, absolutely. We could definitely, you know, keep the conversation going as we proceed.
Oh, yes.
And I know there's been some great questions from the community as well that we'll address as we kind of, you know, get into this. We're going to look at basically three topics. Very quickly looking at some disability statistics, because I suspect people don't understand how large this community is.
This was one of the things that going through that book really did open my eyes. And obviously, like, people in the community know that I've got, you know, kind of my own sort of mobility issues happening with my hands and things. But when you actually look at the percentages, just to tease it, when you actually look at the percentages and, like, you know, how many people this opens everything up to, it really does open your eyes to what you can do.
Yeah, exactly. And the knowledge that we'll probably all end up with a disability at some point.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about that as well. Then we'll get into what authors and creatives can actually control within their platforms and where they should be taking note. And then we'll get into like five areas where you can get started. Like as soon as you're done with this class, you can go start doing some of this stuff better with these five areas.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at the statistics, there's four types of primary disability out there where everything kind of slots into. Motor impairment, so where you can't move as you would expect to, whether it's you might be in a wheelchair, you might be paralyzed, you might have lost a limb. There could be, you know, whatever that is that impacts the way that you move. That's 11.1% of the population of the U.S. These statistics particularly are from U.S.-based from the Centers of Disease Control, looking at the population who is known to be disabled. And we'll talk more about what that means in just a minute. Cognitive impairments. So you're thinking here of things like people on the autism spectrum, people with attention deficit, people who have dyslexia. You know, really anything that causes you to not necessarily process things, whether it's text or images or audio and video, things that move. Mm-hmm. The way that you process the information, that falls in the cognitive. And that's 10.9%, again, of the U.S. population. People who have auditory problems. So obviously that's the way you hear, whether it's full deafness, hearing loss, other things that might go wrong with the hearing, 5.7%. And then the visual disabilities, blindness, of course, but also color blindness, low vision. You know, I know how, you know, impaired I would be if my glasses were broken.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the screen is like, you know, less than 2 feet in front of me, it would be very difficult for me to read it, even with the size of the type the way it is.
Yeah.
So that's 4.9% of the population. Around the world, more than 1 billion people live with some form of a disability. That's a big number.
1 in 8 at this point now.
Right. In the U.S., that's 61 million adults. According to the CDC. In Canada, 6 million people age 15 and older, according to government information. In the UK, 4.6 million adults, again, coming from the UK government.
Mm-hmm.
Across the rest of the European Union, over 100 million adults. And these are just the known disabilities, people who have somehow maybe registered for disability, you know, from the government payments. Maybe it's an insurance thing. It may have been marked on a census type survey at some point. So this is just the known population. And that works out between 15 and 25% of the adults have some sort of disability, depending on, you know, where in the world you are. So yes, it comes back to that 15% if you look across the billion.
Hmm.
But like here in the US, you're closer to 25% of the population.
That's, if there's anything people take away from this, obviously like all of it will be gold, but just that in itself is huge. Because if you're looking at 25% of possible people for readership to advertise towards, to, you know, reach, and you are negating, you know, 1 out of 4 people that are coming to try and get entertainment, trying to find you, that is something that should not be ignored, especially if there are easy fixes for some of these things.
Yeah, exactly. It's a staggering number. And now we're going to make it even more staggering.
Uh-oh.
So consider things like this, a temporary disability. You know, I mentioned breaking my glasses. That'd be temporary because I'd go get some new ones. Might take some time, but I'd get new ones. Think about somebody breaking their wrist. Like if I broke my right wrist, that impacts my ability to use my trackpad and a mouse or whatever my pointer device is. So I would need to use the keyboard for some span of time. There are situational disabilities. So if I'm in a noisy location, I might want to rely on captions or transcripts more because maybe I can't hear what I'm trying to engage with. If I'm holding a baby in my arms or my hands are full, I may need to use some kind of voice technology to make my phone do something. You know, how often do we ask our phones to do something for us? That's a form of assistive technology right there. Then there's episodic disabilities. People who have migraines, when they have a migraine, it changes the way they, interact with the world for the span of that flare-up. People who have severe disability flare-ups, or sorry, severe arthritis flare-ups, maybe they can't use the mouse in that time, so they're back to a keyboard. So all of this really inflates the number. So many consider the population who's affected at any given time to be more in the 40 to 50% range. And these are the ones that you just can't track as well. And somewhere in there too, are people who perhaps just, get a disability and it doesn't really get, like written down somewhere to end up in the first numbers. Everybody, as we all age, we all, our hearing starts to dissipate, our vision starts to dissipate, other things crop up. And that falls somewhere in, the gray area between all of these different numbers, how they might get categorized. So it's a large number of the population who can, benefit from making our content accessible. So what is it that authors can actually do? And to start off with that, let's talk about the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines for a minute. These have been around since 2000. And they are like they are the fundamentals that you look at when you're going to take action on accessibility and think about making the content and the website, et cetera, accessible. This is what I talk about in my day job all day long. And there's four principles around this. The first one's perceivable, which states that you have to present information in multiple ways. Text on the screen gets read by a screen reader. So what's visually available becomes available via audio. That same text can be translated by a different kind of screen reader to Braille. So then it becomes tactile at the same time. So it's about presenting that information and making sure it's available in multiple ways so it can be interacted with however appropriate. We do this with our books all the time, right? You've got your ebook, you've got a print book, you may have a large print book so that then it's in a bigger size for people. You have an audio book for people who may choose to engage with audio. And then, of course, some of our e-reader devices will also allow a voice to read to you straight off the EPUB like a Kindle Fire does. Different ways to present the same information. The web and all the content has to be operable, meaning that I need to be able to operate it with the keyboard in the same way I can operate it with a mouse. I need to be able to speak to the computer, potentially, to get it to do things for me. One of the people we interviewed for the book actually has severe pain, and that becomes their motor disability. If Heather Neff has to use her mouse or her keyboard too much, she's in pain. So she uses voice navigation on the computer as much as she can to alleviate that. So the operability is important. As you can imagine, we want everything to be understandable. The content we put out there, but also the way that our websites behave. You don't want somebody to come to a site and go, "I don't understand what to do here," because maybe it's over-designed or the navigation's not clear, things like that. And then the fourth one is robust. And this is really one that this audience really won't deal with. This is the more technical thing, that the site needs to be coded correctly. And in this case, we rely on the platforms that we use to take care of the robustness of things, that the site's going to function correctly, that it's going to be on a phone correctly versus a tablet versus a desktop, et cetera. But it's just good to know that that exists as part of the overall requirements that we have.
And is there a standard that certain softwares and platforms have to meet before they launch? Is this kind of like the robustness bake actually Is it policy to be baked into all of the platforms, or are there some that aren't quite there?
It should be baked in because the robustness is really based in good HTML syntax at the end of the day, which
Okay.
everybody should be doing. I could tell you there's a lot of sloppiness out there in
Yep,
what I see. And part of that is because the modern day browsers can correct so many of the syntax issues. They can still cause problems, though, to some assistive technologies, which is why it's part of the guideline.
gotcha.
Around the world, there are different laws that situate around the topic. And I'll say here, as you might expect, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not providing any legal advice here. Although we do talk with a lawyer in the book to discuss some of the aspects that creatives might want to think about, just to be aware of for their businesses. But around the world, there's different variations on how the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines play into it. They may be overtly referenced, as they are in places like France and other places in the EU. They might just be the once it's in the US around a lot of litigation, because there are no hard and fast guidelines that are actually law, unless you look at like the airline industry, who is mandated to be compliant to these guidelines. It's a bit of a mess over here with how that happens. And hopefully over time, we want the Department of Justice or Congress to actually amend our Americans with Disabilities Act to, more formally enshrine what this means. Because there's also, without getting too into the weeds, the idea that nobody in the disability community is going to care if you've ticked every box on the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, as long as you're providing an accessible experience.
Yes.
And you can be accessible without ticking every guideline necessarily. It's
Gotcha.
a balancing act.
Yep,
Anyway,
yep.
that's too much about my day job.
Yeah.
These are the conversations I have.
Yeah.
And there is one question that came in from Kiz here about, is it necessary to make things accessible for people of all forms of disability? And the way that these guidelines are set up and the way that we outline things in the book, it's not really about doing a bunch of things to make the site accessible for visual impairments and then doing another set of things for operable impairments and another set of things for auditory impairments. When you take these into account, you're ticking often a lot of boxes at the same time. So if Perceivable, for example, takes care of visual, it helps to take care of auditory in some cases, because it's available to a screen reader to read out or to be tactile in Braille, if necessary. Operable takes into a number of ways across all the impairments to make things operable. One of the things we've got in the book too is for each of the things we indicate that an author can take on to fix is who benefits from it. And
Yes.
we list out, this helps people with visual impairments. The same thing will also help people with motor impairments and cognitive impairments. So it all ties together, which is great, so that we're not having to think about certain things for certain categories. It's all encompassing, which I think makes it a lot easier. So in the book, we tackle 16 topics that we think either people need to just flat out do or things to think about. So in that flat out just do it are things like managing images and non-text content. And when I talk about things like non-text content, that gets into like buttons and things like that, where there may be text on them, but the element itself isn't actual text.
Yes.
How to manage images that have a lot of text in them. Titling pages, doing headings, which I think most people misuse, and we'll talk a little bit about in a future slide. Using color correctly and minding good color contrast. How you create link text. Making sure the language of the page and other parts of the page is addressed correctly. There's so much about audio and video to take into account. You want to do content that doesn't cause people to have seizures, of course, because that would be, that'd be terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Then some of the things that we want the audience to be aware of are like if they're using carousels and videos and animations and some of the impacts those can have. Some things they'll be able to fix. Some things might be more of a long-term situation for them. We don't expect anybody to be able to deal with their own keyboard navigation unless they happen to be a developer on the side. But you need to be aware of how your site does interact with the keyboard and the focus order and the visible focus just so that you know what you've got. Same thing with modifying anything around instructions, labels, and error messages for any of the widgets you may use. Like, you know, think about a basic newsletter sign up. If you put in an email address that isn't the right format, it's probably going to pop up a message saying, you know, invalid email address if you maybe leave the .com off or something. Fixing that's going to be outside your ability because, you know, getting in there to do something to that probably came from the email platform. But if it's a problem, you should know about it. Pop-up windows can be a huge problem. So we tell you how to review your pop-up windows if you're using them to make sure they're working right. Consistency is important and usually something the platforms take up pretty well. But again, things to think about. And if you're using tables, we give you a whole bunch of things to think about because tables can be really tricky to make accessible correctly. Just thinking about, you know, does a table need to be read row to row to row or column to column to column? And making sure like a screen reader would be able to manage that appropriately. So we give you some tips on tables. And then a whole bunch of stuff around clear, concise, easy to read content. So those are the 16 things that we really dive in on. And we look at these through the lens of social media, emails, and your website. So where can you get started with this? And getting started, I think, is so very important. We're going to look at 5 things here. The images and images of text, the use of color and color contrast, link text, audio and video, and then that clear, concise, easy to read content.
I like how you prioritize this.
I was thinking about this. It's like, these are things you could walk away from this and even start doing now.
Yes.
Absolutely. You know, on things that you're doing just going forward. And Rob had a great question about, you know, planning and publishing accessibility first content. And it really can start here with these 5 things. I mean, nobody's going to be able to take all 16 of those things that I listed there and go do them tomorrow.
Yeah.
As much as you may want to, you've got to start to understand them. You've got to figure out which ones you want to implement first. You've got to think about, is it just about content going forward, which is fine. I would encourage everybody to start doing this stuff going forward. But then how much are you going to go back and retrofit, you know, the sites that exist currently? You know, I've got 4 or 5 sites that I manage for what we do here. I've done my best to update all of them, but certainly I've got blog posts that go back 15 years. I'm not going to go back and fix all of those. That's mind-blowing, you know, to have to go back and do that. Some of it comes down to the 80-20 rule, but then also making sure that you're balancing it to, again, take into account that large number of people who may need you to do these things. Mm-hmm. Which is why when I think about the website itself, you know, make sure your homepage is as accessible as it can be because that's the gateway.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the next level down from the homepage, whatever your top navigation is, clean that up. Take care of book pages or, you know, whatever that thing is that you're selling to people and that you want people to buy. Make sure those are good. 15 years of blog post? Maybe not.
Yeah, yeah. You know? That's it. It's all priorities, isn't it? It's like where can the biggest impact come from the minimum effort to begin with and then just working down through that list.
Yeah, and it's getting better as you go. A good example I'll give is Big Gay Fiction. Our first 180 episodes don't have transcripts. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the financial resource to make them. We didn't have the time to make them. And we're going backwards now and filling in those, and that just takes time and resources to do it. But starting at 180, we started always having the author interviews transcribed. And at some point, somewhere in the 200s, we started providing transcripts to the entire show. So we evolved and we are trying to go backwards, but it's a balancing act.
Yes.
One of the key tenets in accessibility for everybody is really progress over perfection. Perfection is very hard to achieve.
Yeah.
I mean, even with the clients I work with who are dedicated to this, absolute perfection, ticking every box of the web content accessibility guidelines is very difficult. Mm-hmm. Progress over perfection. Start now, improve.
Yes.
That's what's important.
Yeah. Because only in starting can you ever learn what your capacity is to actually then implement some of that stuff. Because like you say, like you can do the transcriptions and all that kind of stuff on the podcast side, but suppose someone podcasts in the 10 minutes extra they have per day. Maybe they're not able to go through that, but they can implement something else that would benefit in some way or another.
And maybe over time, you figure out how to integrate that for your podcast into your workflows. It's all about the workflows. So let's talk a little bit about images of text and the all-important alternative text. Regardless of the platform that you're putting something in on, WordPress and Wix and all the mail platforms and all the social platforms have somewhere that you could put alternative text in for that content. You may need to look at your help documentation if you don't know where that is, but it's there somewhere, sometimes buried, as is the case with some social media platforms. The context for what you put in that alternative text matters. You want it to be meaningful so that if someone can't see the image, what information do they need to fully understand your content? And it may not be, and often is not, a description of the actual image. So what we have on the screen here is the homepage to Jeff Adams Writes. And it's broken down. There's a quick little introduction. There are several headings in play here. The first one relates to my email magnet. The second one relates to the Content for Everyone book. And the third one is the Codename Winger series. Those are actually headers. I'm not talking about headers much in this class, but those are tagged as headers, so that somebody who is reading this through a screen reader knows that those are the main sections of this page, and it helps them break down the information in a way that they can navigate the site faster. Because as a visual person, I have a lot of visual cues I can take here. Using headings properly is a good cue for people who maybe are not taking it in visually.
Yeah. If people are a bit unsure on how to implement headings and whatnot, you will tend to find that in pretty much every text editor, you have the option to have paragraph text and then your different heading one, heading two layered into your text that then the reader of whatever kind will pick that up and display that for you in that manner.
Exactly. Right. And then we go into a lot more of how to use those correctly. And nest them and things like that within the book itself. Or maybe that's Masterclass Part 2 someday.
Yes.
We'll see. So with the images here, there are 6 images on the page, and they're all book covers. For each one of those, I actually use an empty alternative text, which means it won't be read out at all to a screen reader of any kind. And I do that because all of these are decorative. Mm-hmm. Because in each case, the important information is adjacent to the image. And even with the Codename Winger books, you can't see what's under that. But directly under that is a text link that is the title of each book that then goes to, the information page about the book. So in those cases, the screen reader user doesn't need to know about those because they don't matter to them because of all the text that's around them. Because they don't need to know what's on those covers. It just doesn't matter. Another example of context matters. So what's on the site on the screen right now is the top 20 t-shirts from Woot. If you haven't never looked at a Woot t-shirt, you should do that because they're fabulous. What does something mean when it says the Beagles or attempted murder or vintage sci-fi convention or adulthood is a scam? There's nothing present to tell you what the actual image looks like. I don't know what I'm buying. Do I want to click on any of those? There's no way to know if I can't see the image. So if I pop in the image, now you could see everything. But each one of those should actually carry a meaningful alt text that tells you what's on that t-shirt so that somebody who isn't looking at the image will go, oh, 4 Snoopies walking across the street looking like Abbey Road. My brother would love that. Let me buy that shirt. Let me click in and see what's there to understand more about that shirt. And I can tell you that Woot's not doing this correctly too. So that's why context matters. The book covers didn't matter. But in this case, in this context, what's on those shirts matters and it needs to be there so that the user, can go take action. I mean, imagine if this was a cover, a cover site where you're buying covers. Usually those are just images without even any link under them that gives the title some kind of a meaningful name. Mm-hmm. So a cover artist would definitely want to engage in alternative text Keep in mind, too, that alternative text actually displays on the screen if the images can't load or if somebody has the images not allowing to load on their browser for whatever reason. So the alternative text plays an important role for them as well. So
So would
meaningful
that include
alternative
things like,
text is so important.
would that include things like safe mode on browsers and computers and
Depends on how you've got it set. Because usually the safe mode has a whole bunch of settings on what you're going to allow and not allow, but it's definitely one that could be in there as well.
gotcha.
So talking about images of text a little bit, these are never accessible and you should really not use them. But practically speaking, we're going to use them anyway. So I'm not going to tell you not to use them, but let's talk about the ways you can make them as accessible as possible. And I've done this with what is displaying on the screen, which is an image that I put together for one of the Codename Winger books. And it talks about, teen secret agent, security hack, must save dad. So it's got these, plot points and tropey things around it, all pointing to the book cover. So as you make these things, you want to think about an easy to read font and font size. No curly Q font, nothing that, somebody who's dyslexic or low vision may be like, I can't quite make out what that is. Good color contrast, and we'll talk about what good color contrast is in a bit. You want to have clear meanings, so don't throw a lot of jargon in there that might throw somebody off. Be clear in your message as you would want to be with any promotional image. And where possible, restate the text that's in the image on the page that it sits on, or in the social post that it sits on, and certainly in the alternative text that goes with it. You could turn all of everything that's in this image into a sentence
Yeah.
that could be in the post or be in the alternative text.
And it's probably worth adding as well that when it comes to the algorithms in quotes, promoting images that you put on social media, there was, this was a couple of years ago, I imagine it's still a thing, what they call the 10% rule of text to image ratio, in which the algorithms will detect how much text is on your page and they'll promote those that are less text heavy on the image itself. So you can find websites where you can find out what your ratio of image to text is to see if it complies to help your post get promoted. So often it's definitely worth in images trying to reduce that text as much as possible anyhow.
Yeah. And you'll find too, I mean, and for SEO, SEO can't read what's in the text, what's in the image, locked up in the image. It reads what's on the page. And you'll find often that the more you do for accessibility, the better it is for your SEO too. If you're like, trying to play an SEO game or an algorithm game, which almost all of us are, to some degree for the discoverability. So using automatically generated text. And we'll talk about this a couple of times as it relates to alternative text, and then again later for like transcriptions. Facebook and Instagram will automatically generate an alternative text always, which means you can never have a decorative alternative text in Facebook. So what Facebook generated for this was this. Which is a bunch of gobbledygook. Teen secret agent, security hack, codename tracker, hacker, Jeff Adams, must save dad. Intriguing, a fun, and adventure. Random quotation marks, some words that don't make sense. What it's doing is it's reading the text left to right, even though it doesn't make sense when you do that, because it doesn't understand. It perceives a bunch of text and it just puts it out there.
I can't figure out where I got the store the names from.
In the blurb, it's somehow it's mucking up the word "The Extraordinaries," which is T.J. Klune's book.
Okay.
Yeah, it took me a while to sort out where all this came from, but it makes it a mess. So, even if you put this in a post where you had all this text in the post already, you still have to go do something with the alternative text. And I know I've got a plugin that I use that lets me see all the alternative text on the social media without actually using an assistive technology. It never gets the auto-generated stuff right. Never. Usually it's very generic of like, maybe a picture of three people outdoors. Okay.
Beautiful.
Here's another example. picking on Facebook a little bit. So what's on the screen is a post that I did last year when I was doing a reader promotion. And I was very clear about Read With Pride, 60 plus authors have branded together to offer you fabulous MM romance reads for Pride Month and beyond. Many are discounted, but for a limited time only. And then I talked about my book that I had in and that it, what that book was about and that it was on sale for 99 cents. And then some stuff about the authors who were taking place. And then it has an image with the official logo that we were using for the promotion. And then my book with its little 99 cent burst on it. Facebook generated may be an image of text that says 1 106 2 I 99 read with pride. It's like some of this I never sorted where it came from.
It's like a bit of a game.
And so, you know, I had to put something else in the alternative field. And what I did was a little bit long, probably, but I covered exactly what was pretty much stated in that image, you know, giving a sense of what the promotional graphic was, talking a little bit more about my book cover, because I had to put something there, even though I would have again liked in this case for that alternative text to have been empty because everything was in the post.
Yeah.
Thank you, Facebook. So let's talk about the use of color a little bit. So there's a good, some good examples on my page here. So my links, for example, are not defined only by color. Mm-hmm. At some point in the design sphere, it became unpopular to underline links. But if you're have if you're somebody who is low vision, maybe you're colorblind, you need a little more to find those because maybe you can't perceive the red. So the underline is a great way to help, you know, emphasize where the links are. Mm-hmm. Also, the blue that I'm using, the blue when it's blue text on white, and also when it's white text on blue, that all meets proper color contrast guidelines, which state that you need your contrast to be 4.5 to 1, you know, foreground to background. There is a brilliant contrast checker at webaim.org/resources/contrast checker. You simply put in the hex codes, which of course you can get from any number of design tools that we all use. You put the hex codes in for the foreground and the background, and it's going to tell you if it passes or not. And it's very helpful because there are sliders under both the background and the foreground. So you can make them lighter and darker and find the color that's in your color family that actually does meet the contrast. And sometimes it's just nudging it a little bit one way or the other to get that one that's going to, you know, be the right contrast.
Yeah. Perfect example of when that never works is pink and green.
Yes,
pink I've and seen green those on are... my old business used to be like clubs and bars and things, and they loved a good pink and green flyer.
Yeah, that's never going to work. No matter how dark and light you make it, you'll never find the right one. Speaking of,
there you go,
some pastel green. So I came across this with an author who I recently interviewed for Big Gay Fiction, and Anli was a champ and let me use this as an example.
Nice.
This is also a great example of when you have a conversation and you educate somebody that they fix it. Because within a couple hours after I talked about this with Anli, she came back to me and was like, I've changed everything. How's this look? And she created one that met the right color contrast standard, which was brilliant. Mm. All about spreading the message. So yeah. I think we all recognize a good link tree when we see one. Yeah. And this is just a portion of it. There are a few options on this link tree beyond what I'm showing here of like the half dozen.
Yeah.
So this background is pale green, pastel green. So there's very poor contrast with white text. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happens here that you can't tell from the image is that the background colors are continuously changing through a whole rainbow of pastel colors. The contrast never lines up right because it's all pastel colors with the white. But that constant movement's a problem too. You know, back in the Big 16 list was the piece about things that start automatically moving, like a carousel or an animation or something. Those could be a big distraction for people who have attention deficit. It could be a big distraction for somebody trying to read something. You know, even if the contrast was right, trying to read while the background's constantly moving can be difficult for any number of people. Mm. So, you know, things to think about there. And there's a curly, fancy font that is used here. which, can be difficult for like dyslexics to read. Even if the color contrast was right, trying to parse the words with that curly font can be a problem. So, we ticked off a few things here, but this is another, great example of color contrast.
I'm getting very strong flashbacks to in my old day job. One of them, because I run the marketing department, the design team were very keen on those kind of script style fonts. And the CEO rightly pointed out that, when used in certain situations a lot, like especially as like a primary text as it is in this case, but like it just detracts from any of that message. And I think one of the problems when it comes to design, especially when authors are looking at their own brand and their own kind of, stretching the brand through things like Linktree and all the different ancillary stuff, is trying too hard to make an impression and not prioritizing enough the journey of the reader. Because at this point, have some of your brand, have like a lick of your brand in there, but the whole point of a Linktree is what do you click to get to where you need to go? And the simpler you can make that, the more like the easier you can make that journey, just the more effective that conversion is going to be. Because I'd be put off by this trying to like hunt through and find what it was I wanted.
Exactly. And connected to what you said, we often think about what we like
Yes.
as the person who's putting it together. And it doesn't always mean that it works for somebody else. This Linktree is gorgeous. It's just not very usable. Watching the colors turn and everything, I was like very into that as like, a screensaver concept maybe. But you have to think about, everybody else and making sure you're including everybody else. It's all about inclusion and making the audience feel welcome to the experience.
Yeah. And just a personal point, that Patreon being a different color really puts me off. That's a real pet
Oh,
peeve.
right. Yeah. Suddenly orange.
Yep. I get why, but yeah.
So some more on link text as well. I'll pop back here to the links I had on my page. They're very descriptive about where you're going. Find out more about the Hockey Player Snow Day and sign up to get your free ebook now. Get your ebook now available, at my site, etc. So there's very prescriptive. So I'm picking on Bargain Booksy a little bit here on this example. You really want to avoid things like click here, read more by now. They're not, they don't tell you what's about to happen. Doesn't matter really who you are or what, impairment you may or may not have. Just saying read more, not telling me where I'm going to go read more, why I might want to read more, what I'm reading more about. It's not helpful, and even more so if you've queued up a whole bunch of those, in the email. Redundant links too are very problematic, and because you're giving people a lot of noise and you're giving people the same click without really providing the context behind it. So, the one to focus in here on is the gatekeeper staff that we see, and there's a blurb. But when you think about the links here, the image, the book cover is an image, is a link. The gatekeeper staff is a link. The read more is a link. The get deal on Kindle is a link. It all goes to Amazon. It all goes to the same Amazon page. The only one that's clear about where it's going is that get deal on Kindle. But the other ones, I mean, it can be frustrating for anybody to go click, click, and then, keep going to the same place all the time. So one clear link that's going to send you to where you're going is really the standard that I would love to see people kind of adapt to. And it's the same thing with the invasion book. That's the other example here. It expands a little bit more because you've got get deal on Kindle, get deal on Apple Books, get deal on Kobo, but you still have multiple Amazon links between the book cover, the title invasion, the read more, and the get deal on Kindle. And this plays, into some what so many people view here. For cognitively disabled users, in some cases, depending on what their disability is. Navigating all that can be, take a lot of just mental energy to kind of parse through what it all means instead of having a single clear focus for that link. It's important to understand too what screen reader users have at their fingertips. They can call up for whatever page or email that they're on a list of what the links are and have those read out. You could see here, in particular, two links that are just a bunch of alphanumeric gobbledygook. And those relate to the images that are on the page. The images don't have alternative text, so it's using what's available to it from, most likely that's the file name. When it got imported into the email platform, it ended up with some random number, and there it is.
I was going to ask, one of the things that I've really gotten onto with them, because I've just gotten like a little bit into web design over the last year or so, is the convenience of naming your files correctly and how that then interprets often will cascade down into things like this. So it's easier if you forget to adjust for whatever reason.
That is true. I mean, I would rather everybody, you know, use their alternative text appropriately. But yes, if you name your images correctly, it at least gives a better clue than an alphanumeric, you know, soup that we see here. So we also get with this link list, you know, just the frustration of like, these, we know that these things all go to the same place, but there's no clue for this user that, you know, all four links for the gatekeeper staff all go to the same place. So you don't really need to spend the time to click all of them. Audio and video. So anytime you're using audio and video, it's important to make sure you've got multiple ways to perceive it. All the audio programs, so podcasts and such, they got to have transcripts. Videos with sound have to have captions. Videos with important images and text in them must have some form of descriptions. And you may have noticed as we've gone through this, I've been very careful that I really read out everything that's on the screen. I may state it a little differently, so I'm not reading verbatim, but everything that's on the screen, I'm saying it, including giving descriptions of the image examples in case there are people in the audience who can't perceive the deck, the images, whatever that is. So I'm trying to say all of it. These are the three tenets that you really need to pay attention to with audio and video, including, you know, when you're live on Facebook or live on YouTube or live on Instagram, take steps to make sure that you're providing live captions to people. It's the only instance where automated captions and transcripts, well, not transcripts, because transcripts wouldn't be live, but automated captions are acceptable because they'll at least help the users who are there live get something if they can't hear you, if they can't read your lips in the moment. You know, one of the things I've done here is to make sure the mic is, and actually it should be just a little lower. if people are trying to read my lips, that I don't have anything blocking what that is. And actually, I apologize if anybody was trying to do that because the mic could have been a touch lower. So these are the things we have to think about with audio and video, including if we're doing it live to help people out. And don't rely on auto-generated captions and transcripts. Here's an example from a Big Gay Fiction that we did. And this is the auto-generated that we initially got back. Austin and Caleb are so cute as they, capital I, each other, take interest and ultimately spend time talking about all the things they love about writing on actual paper, period. Sadly, comma, it's only a meet cute, meet as M-E-A-T. So what this should be, it also left out the fact that that sentence actually started with and.
Yeah.
And Austin and Caleb are so cute as they eye each other, E-Y-E, comma, take interest, comma, and ultimately spend time talking about all the things they love about writing on actual paper, period. So there were words that were just wrong. There were words missing. There was punctuation out of place. And then, of course, in that last sentence, meet should be M-E-E-T, because there's nothing cute about M-E-A-T necessarily. So, you know, you've really got to take the time to clean them up. And I know that takes time and resource. But in the same way you wouldn't let a book go out, I hope, without a proper proof, you've got to look at these things with captions and transcripts as well to make sure that they turn out right. Yeah. So even if you had automated on like a Facebook Live, take the minute, go back, edit those as it becomes a replay, for example, so that people can interact with it correctly. Because a lot of people love transcripts and captions. People will, you know, I think the data I've seen recently is 70% of people will watch a program with captions, even if they're not hard of hearing, just because it helps them take in the information better. Mm. I use transcripts from podcasts all the time. It's like, I heard this thing on this show. Let me go find that. And it's so much better if I can go in and scan the transcript instead of having to re-listen to an entire show to get like maybe the 30 seconds that I wanted to remind myself of. So there are benefits to doing these, but trust me, as a podcaster, I get that it's not easy or very time friendly.
No, my ex-partner used to more often than not watch social media reels without sound, even if she was in a place in which she could watch with sound, which used to blow my mind.
Yeah, I'll do that with social media all the time. It's like I'll just look at stuff as like
There's a
if I
very
get
high
if I
percentage of
find
people
that it's something I want to hear because I've started reading, it's like I may tap the sound on, but otherwise I'll
Yeah.
just.
It's bizarre behavior when you think about it. Like, it is what it is, but it's strange that people go for all the effort to, make all the sound and everything else, and then even people that can listen are just choosing to watch.
Yeah, we've all got the ways that we want to take stuff in, and for some people they have to take it in through those methods, but others may choose to. So it should just be as right as it can be with what we can do.
Yes.
Clear, concise, easy to read content. I know that this is going to really surprise anybody. The more you can write short, clear sentences and offer simplicity. But let's be honest, this isn't trying to say, don't write about complex things, just distill it down into simple. It's what we did with this entire book. We had a whole revision, kind of two revisions, because we had to present this information to its intended audience, which is not the audience that we talk to in our day jobs for me and Michele. I needed to write this so that Will could understand what I needed, what they needed to do, because Will doesn't have technical knowledge. Will knows how to use the support, that's inside the platforms, and he knows how to use those platforms. And then he comes to me if he doesn't understand it. But if I could write the stuff so that he understood it, then we were doing it right. Complex topics presented in the right, simple way. Acronyms and abbreviations, define them on first use. Not everybody's going to know every acronym that you may put out there. Easy to read fonts. The most accessible fonts that are out there are Tahoma, Times New Roman, and Verdana. Because what you're really looking for there, beyond like not being curly Q's and things like that, is L's, like lowercase L's, ones, and uppercase I's. They should all look different to be a truly accessible font, among other things, because those can really, trip people up. Arial, Calibri, and Helvetica have a lot of accessible characteristics as well. Don't do as great on the LI and one thing, but they're also, inherently accessible in a lot of ways. Readable font size. This blows my mind on social media. People will put things into Instagram stories. It's so teeny tiny. I'm like, I don't know who's reading that. And you can't zoom that stuff.
No.
So if it's tiny, it just doesn't get read. Try to keep your text aligned to the left. If you're having to read and something is centered and you have to kind of move your eye to where the start of the line is, that's more cognitive load to find the start of the line. And it can really be a drain for some people, and it can make the text really inaccessible for some people because of trying to follow and where that is. So align left as much as possible. Don't overuse italics and bold. Each of those things can make something more difficult to read, especially like if it's a large block of italic text. Obviously, use italics for what it's meant for, book titles, TV show titles, etc. But try to stay away from big chunks of it. And same thing with bold. Camel case or Pascal case for hashtags. So saying this is a hashtag where the I, the A, the H, and the T, that the first word, the first letter of the words are capitalized, is so much easier to read than an all lowercase, this is a hashtag, which a screen reader will likely jumble. But if it's capital each word, it'll parse that way. It's also easier, I think, just in general, for everybody to read them when it's capped, which means you have to take more time on social because, like on Instagram and LinkedIn, where it will offer you the suggestions, they don't follow this rule. And so you still have to type them in, but it's worth it because then people can, engage with the hashtags a little bit better.
It can also keep you out of trouble for any possible typos as well. I saw one yesterday that was Volkswagen Italia for obviously Italian Volkswagen, but because it was all just small text, it read Volkswagen Italia. So those accidents which are going to naturally occur, you can kind of avoid some trouble there by being a bit more clear with what you're saying.
Absolutely. That's hilarious. Poor Volkswagen. And don't overuse emojis. because you can confuse people on context, potentially. You can make a screen reader have to work a lot harder to present something. So think about this, because people love emojis and headlines, and sometimes going in between the words, a screen reader would read this out as Starstruck take, Starstruck 40%, Starstruck off, Starstruck today, Starstruck. Because each emoji has its own thing that will perceive out to the screen reader. Somebody who's cognitively disabled, maybe dyslexia, maybe something else, they're going to have to work harder to figure out what the emojis might mean within the context here, why they're between the words. Can they perceive the message that's truly important there, which is take 40% off today, through those emojis? Simplicity. Simplicity rules here. Maybe have a starstruck off at the end as like the, you know, exclamation point or something. But all of them between the words, it's a mess.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some more questions, because we've got some other stuff from the community.
Yes.
Rob said, what do you think the future has in store for accessible content, both online and physically? I think we need more people doing things to make sure their content is accessible. We've seen the numbers, right? And this isn't going to reduce as we all age up. You know, I'm going to want to use the website now, and I'm 55 this year. I'm going to want to keep using it the same way when I'm 65, 75, 85. I know my eyesight is already crap. And it's no doubt going to get worse. So we really need folks to take the initiative to start making the web accessible for everyone. And I mean, I really want to see this conversation come down to not just, you know, creatives and people who run websites and run small businesses on the web. Every single person who posts to a social media site should be thinking about these and being taught how to do this. And Twitter was really the only one of the current socials who put the alt button front and center, so you see it every single time and it's there when you're uploading an image. Facebook and Instagram bury it. You got to know it's there, and you got to know the right taps to get to it.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, pre-Elon Musk, Twitter had a very active accessibility team who worked really hard to make that site and the app as accessible as possible. That got totally dismantled. The alt button is still front and center on the images, though, which is nice when you upload them. So where their accessibility is going to be, you know, in the long term is kind of questionable, but that's something they absolutely got right, was bringing the alt text to the forefront so that it's there and available to you right alongside other image editing tools, whereas it's a little bit buried further down for Facebook and Instagram. So, you know, really, and physically, I think, you know, as we look at our books and the things that we offer, the more I think we can offer at broader price points and the more products we can put out, ebook, paperback, large print. I don't know that there's necessarily an accessible aspect to hardback. You know, it's standard and it's large.
Yes.
And being able to provide audio. And I think, you know, it's one of the arguments in my mind. I know AI audio is controversial in a lot of circles. But I think what it does do is allow a lower price point for audio, which can be very beneficial because for people who are disabled, and especially those living with permanent disabilities who are in that, you know, people we know who are disabled because of the government and those statistics, they're often underemployed. So they're not employed to their full skill often. They're underpaid. So at the same time, they're not making as much money as some of their counterparts. And then you have to think about, you know, how much discretionary income they may have because of things they may have to pay for their disability to be able to live. Hearing aids, for example, cost thousands of dollars. And here in the US, the insurance doesn't pick up that much of it. So, you know, they're not necessarily going to spend discretionary income on a KU, a KU subscription, an Audible subscription. They're going to want to get their books potentially from the library.
Yeah.
So having them available wide, they may need a lower price point to engage with an audiobook. that, you know, an AI generated one would let them have, because those can be so much cheaper than a fully produced. And don't get me wrong, I love a fully produced audiobook. I will buy those all day long. But we have to think about, you know, in the same way we've got ebooks, paperbacks, hardbacks that have a different price point, having audio at a different price point as well can be very beneficial. So a little bit of a rant there,
No,
but
it works.
it feeds into accessibility as well, in making things available to those who need them. Because again, while a Kindle Fire may read out an EPUB to me, not everybody can afford a Kindle Fire. So,
Absolutely.
let's see, a couple other questions. Robin Kiz kind of had something similar here. How would you approach readers to get feedback on how accessible content is based on their specific needs? And would advertising your content as accessible friendly be exploiting an underrepresented fan base, or simply be a way of raising awareness? So I don't advocate necessarily advertising it, because at the end of the day, to be blunt, this is something we should all be doing anyway. Period. I think the best way that this can be communicated that you're doing something is to use an accessibility statement. Because essentially, that statement will say, I understand this is a thing. I'm doing things to help make it more accessible. And oh, if you run into a problem or need something accessible, here's how you can get in touch with me to ask about it. You could see an example of this on contentforeveryone.info. That's a pretty basic one. You can also see how I modified it if you look at the Big Gay Fiction podcast accessibility statement. Because there I talk specifically about the transcripts, where the transcripts, you know, where they start, where they improve. And if you need something transcribed that isn't done yet, by all means contact, because, you know, we're putting stuff in the backlog. We could certainly, you know, prioritize one up because maybe somebody wants it. So you could check those out and, you know, see if those might meet your needs for a statement that you'd be willing to put out there. And also, if you're doing an event, because this is one place that we do ask. Part of the interview sign up scheduling thing for Big Gay Fiction has the question in it: are there any accommodations we can provide that would make this interview more accessible for you? So it gives people the opportunity to say, you know, the things I've gotten back so far is, can you please make sure our automated captions are available? Which my Zoom is configured in a way that they're always available. But it's great that that these authors, you know, let me make sure that that's still there, because sometimes Zoom changes the settings without warning.
So you can bake that straight into Zoom where it just picks you up.
Yeah. You could bake it in so that somebody can click the closed caption button and they'll just start being available as the
Interesting.
conversation goes.
There you go.
And those accommodations could be anything. I actually interviewed somebody, they didn't put this in the form. They were very anxious about the interview and wanted to know if I minded if they took an occasional hit off a vape pen to help manage the anxiety. And I'm like, of course not. But we agreed, because it was on video, that there would, if they needed to do that, they would say, 1 second, do it. And so I could cut it out. But, you know, that's an example of an accommodation that they needed to help manage their anxiety in the moment. Absolutely. You know, let's do that. And then two more. Robin Kiz had some similar ideas. How do you think accessible content can be used to help shape a creator's publishing strategy? And how do you think accessible content would impact a creator's publishing strategy in regard to scope, time, and planning? So we talked a little bit about the books themselves. And if you're going to do all of those formats, you certainly have to plan for that, think about it in your production schedule, when they'll roll out, and the time that you put towards those. You may have noticed when I talked about this book, the audiobook is delayed, because that's more time, and I'll get there soon. So, and you can communicate that to users. I think almost everybody expects, you know, especially from indies, that audiobooks are going to be not day and date for the most part. We're getting better at it as a collective indie community, but still. And in terms of, you know, doing stuff on the web and your emails and your social, I think as you learn about it, it's going to become easier for you to do it. And it's going to just essentially become like muscle memory. Put that alternative text in, do the right colors, do these things. It could take some time as you're getting used to them. You know, maybe it sits on a checklist, alternative text, proper colors. And then eventually, you know, you don't need that checklist anymore because it's just things that you do.
Yes.
So it gets better over time. But coming back to progress over perfection too, like we talked about, you know, when we started, doing something and trying to get consistent with it and build that habit so it becomes what you do always is the way to go. And the more you do it, the easier it becomes. It becomes less of a potential time and resource drain because it just is.
Yeah. Like you say, just being aware in the first place that a lot of this stuff exists, you'll start to notice it more. And then you'll begin to see how easy it is to implement a lot of these things.
I can't unsee it.
Yeah.
It's everywhere I go. And keep that in mind, too. I mean, just do what you can to make yourself better potentially in the moment than your competitors are.
Yeah.
Because it's a problem that everyone faces. So you don't need to feel bad that you have this problem. I would say just, you know, do what you can to get started and start taking action and spread the word.
Yes.
As you start to see things, Dan and people listening, gently point out, hey, these colors, that looks difficult. And just be gentle with it because nobody sets out to do these things. But, you know, I've found among this creative community that just saying, hey, I think you might want to rethink this because of these reasons. It's always embraced with, oh my God, let me go, you know, either fix that now or fix it as soon as I can, because I want to be accessible for my audience and potential audience.
Absolutely. And like you say, just that expectation as well, even like just the statement, I'll admit I've not got on my website yet, but it's something I'll definitely look at implementing. Just that expectation so that people know that it's on your mind, just explicitly saying like, this is a thing I'm aware of. It is something that I'm working towards, then puts in that understanding between you and whoever's looking that, like, you know, you're not there yet, maybe to their satisfaction, but it's a rolling thing that you are trying to build and just get better at. And realistically, that's all we can do, especially when we are, you know, most of the time one people businesses that are trying to run.
Yeah, exactly.
I have an additional question for you as well, just as it pertains to is there anything specific you have to be aware of when it comes to web design and looking at particularly at desktop versus say tablet or mobile? Because I know obviously like one of the things that I come across a lot in trying to like shift and move websites and things about is how the information changes between formats, because obviously so many different screens, different sizes, websites now have to be somewhat responsive to the needs of the user. Is there anything specific or useful to bear in mind when designing a website and looking at specifically the PC versus the mobile?
That really crosses into some heavy duty technical areas. I mean, if you're working with a skilled developer, hopefully you're working with somebody who is versed in this work, and they're not always. Even today, there are still developers who may say, oh yeah, I can do that, but then really not cover everything that needs to be done.
It's taken me a couple of years, but I've only just gotten there.
Because there are things to think about, you know, as a nav that might be running across the screen, you know, is accessible. But then when it collapses into the hamburger menu, that maybe it becomes not accessible for whatever reason. And then how to fix that and how to make sure it identifies. One of the key things that I've seen a lot with some of my clients is what's inside that menu may actually be accessible, but for some reason, the hamburger icon itself or the button isn't properly labeled for accessibility, and that it becomes not clear that that's the button to use to get inside of the screen.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, the screen reader user will end up inside the menu even if they didn't open it while they're trying to get somewhere else on the actual rest of the page. So not to scare folks, but these are the things that, you know, we look at. Yes. on these kind of things. So if you're working with somebody on that, you know, we talk about in the book some of the questions to ask designers and developers you may work with to try to tease out if they know what they're doing in this space. Because I don't have a great, you know, kind of silver bullet answer for that, because there's a lot of stuff that goes in there and it's really reliant on a lot of technical stuff, how it works when it collapses from one screen size to another.
Mm. Gotcha. Were there any more questions on that list that you wanted to touch on?
I'm pretty sure I hit all of them.
Let me take Amazing. A quick
step back here. Yeah, I think they got them.
Beautiful.
And of course, the email address is here. So if people do have questions over time, you know, happy to help out as however I can on that.
Absolutely. And I'm putting you on the spot now, so I'm happy to get this bit out. But are you happy for people to message you directly in Slack as well? Because obviously you are in the community too.
Yeah, absolutely. I am in the Activated Author community. So you can, you know, either hit the email address up or, you know, hit me up on Slack. And sometimes you may find that I give unsolicited accessibility advice in Slack too, which I've done to a few people occasionally as well.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for jumping on and talking all things accessibility. I know that, you know, people in the community will take a lot from this. And as you say, there is so much more in the book. And it really is divided into a way in which, you know, if there's a specific thing that you want to look at, it's very easy to find. You can see what impacts what type of disability quite straightforward in that process. So, but yeah, thank you so much, Jeff. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. It's been great.
No worries.
Activate your energy.